A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Welcome to my weird prompts. The difference between a plainclothes officer spotting trouble at a protest and an officer who spent 2 years living as a member of a motorcycle gang. It's not just about the jacket they wear. It's about whether they can ever go home again. Daniel sent us a prompt about this hidden world of long-term undercover police. How many of these officers does a force actually have? What are they assigned to? And how do you protect someone from reprisals after a conviction when their cover wasn't even blown in court? It's a whole different species of police work.
It's closer to spycraft than to anything you'd see in a patrol car. I think that's the thing most people don't grasp until they really dig into it. There's this three-tier model that helps frame it. You've got your uniformed officer, visible, identifiable, the deterrent walking down the street. Then you've got plainclothes officers. They're not in uniform, but they're still operating as police officers. Protest spotters, detective units, they might look like civilians, but if you ask them, they have to identify themselves as police. Their authority isn't hidden, their appearance is.
Then the third tier is where the floor drops out. Undercover officers, identity fully concealed, often living under a false name for years.
And here's the key point that most coverage misses. Undercover officers are a tiny, tiny subset of plainclothes. The vast majority of plainclothes officers have no cover identity at all. They're just cops in jeans. An undercover officer has an entirely fabricated life, a legend, in the tradecraft term, that they inhabit full-time, sometimes for years, with no visible connection to any police force.
We're talking about a spectrum where the visible cop is one end, and the other end is someone who effectively doesn't exist as a police officer in any public sense. Which raises the question you can't really ask about the first two tiers. How many of these ghosts does a police force actually have?
The numbers are deliberately opaque for obvious reasons, but we do have some estimates. The UK Police Federation put out a figure in 2023, roughly 200 to 300 active undercover officers across all 43 territorial police forces in England and Wales, plus the National Crime Agency's dedicated units. That's it, 200 to 300 people in a country of about 60 million.
That's fewer than the number of people who claim to have seen a ghost in any given year. And in the US...
No centralized data, which should tell you something right there. But the FBI's undercover operations program, this is from a 2024 unclassified estimate, has roughly 1,200 active undercover agents at any given time. And that's just the FBI. Add in the DEA, ITF, Homeland Security, and the larger local forces like NYPD's Intelligence Bureau, and you're probably looking at a few thousand nationwide. Still microscopic compared to the roughly 700,000 sworn law enforcement officers in the country.
We've established that undercover officers are a rare breed. But how rare? And how do police forces decide who gets to wear that particular mask?
The selection pipeline is fascinating and a little unnerving. Most undercover officers are recruited after about 5 to 8 years of regular service. You need someone who's proven they can handle pressure, but not someone so institutionalized that they can't improvise. The psychological screening is intense. They use the MMPI-2, the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, plus structured interviews specifically designed to screen for sociopathy risk.
Wait, there's screening for sociopathy in people they're about to ask to convincingly pretend to be criminals for years.
That's exactly the paradox. You need someone who can lie effortlessly for years, build false relationships, manipulate people into incriminating themselves, and then come home and be a normal human being who doesn't enjoy any of it. The screening is trying to find the person who can do the job without becoming the job, and about 15% to 20% of candidates wash out at the psychological screening stage.
You're looking for a very specific kind of person. Someone who can inhabit a false identity without losing their grip on their real one. What happens after they pass the screening?
They enter a dedicated training program that runs 6 to 12 months. This is where it gets into genuine intelligence agency territory. They learn tradecraft, how to build and maintain a cover story, how to handle surveillance, how to extract information without asking direct questions. They go through stress inoculation exercises where they're put in high-pressure scenarios and have to maintain their cover. The UK's National Undercover Unit runs a program that includes what they call cover story construction, building a legend that can withstand background checks, casual questioning, and sustained scrutiny.
These legends, these fabricated lives, how are they actually built? Because we're not talking about a fake name and a backstory you memorize. We're talking about something that has to hold up if someone Googles you, or checks your credit history, or runs into you in a town you claim to have lived in.
This is one of the most elaborate parts of the whole enterprise. Legends are often built using the identities of real but deceased individuals, with family consent, which is a whole ethical layer I want to come back to. The UK's National Undercover Unit maintains a dedicated team of what they call cover managers, people whose full-time job is to build and maintain these legends over years. They create fake employment histories, complete with pay stubs and tax records. They plant credit histories. They build social media footprints that go back years. Photos, posts, friend networks, all fabricated but internally consistent.
Somewhere in an office building, there's a person whose job is to maintain the LinkedIn profile of someone who doesn't exist, making sure the work anniversary posts feel authentic.
That's essentially it. And it's not just LinkedIn, it's utility bills, rental agreements, vehicle registrations. If your cover identity lived in Manchester for 3 years, there needs to be a paper trail showing they paid electricity bills in Manchester for 3 years. The cover managers also handle backstopping. If someone calls the fake employer to verify employment, a cover manager answers the phone and confirms the details.
That's a level of bureaucratic infrastructure I genuinely did not expect. So now we know how many undercover officers exist and how they're selected and trained. What are they actually assigned to do? What's the work?
3 main buckets. The first and largest is organized crime, drug trafficking networks, outlaw motorcycle gangs, people smuggling rings. This is the classic undercover assignment, and it's still the bulk of the work. The second is counterterrorism, domestic extremism, international plots that expanded massively after 9/11. And the third, which has grown significantly in the last decade, is financial crime. Long-term fraud rings, money laundering networks, complex white-collar operations that require someone on the inside to understand the mechanics.
The financial crime one interests me because it's less cinematic. You're not buying drugs from a biker in a warehouse. You're attending board meetings and reviewing spreadsheets. But the infiltration is the same.
In some ways, it's harder. A motorcycle gang member isn't going to check your MBA credentials. A money laundering ring might. The cover has to be more sophisticated. But there's been a broader shift in undercover work since 9/11 that affects all 3 categories. The move from reactive evidence collection to preemptive intelligence gathering. Before 9/11, undercover operations were typically aimed at building a case for prosecution. After, the priority shifted to gathering intelligence that could prevent an attack, disrupt a network, or map a criminal ecosystem, even if that intelligence could never be used in court.
That's the intelligence-to-evidence gap we've discussed before. The information is operationally useful, but legally inadmissible, which means a lot of undercover work ends not in a courtroom, but in a classified file somewhere.
Right, and that's a fundamental tension. Let me give you a concrete example. Operation Galton in the UK, 2010 to 2015. 12 undercover officers infiltrated a single outlaw motorcycle gang chapter over 5 years. They mapped the entire organizational structure, identified supply chains, documented criminal activities. The operation resulted in 40 convictions, but the undercover officers themselves never testified. Their intelligence was used to build the case, but the evidence presented in court came from surveillance, wiretaps, and physical evidence gathered based on what the undercover officers reported.
The undercover officers were the scaffolding, but the prosecution was built on evidence that never revealed their existence. Which loops back to our original question. If the cover is never blown, what happens to the officer after the convictions? Go back to work?
That covers the operational side. But what happens when the operation ends? This is where the real challenge begins, and it's more complicated than most people assume. There's a 3-tier protection framework. Tier 1 is immediate operational security, what they call deconfliction. Making sure that when the arrest happened, nothing in the arrest process, the charging documents, or the initial court filings points back to the undercover officer. If necessary, the officer is pulled out days or weeks before the takedown with a cover story about a family emergency or a new job opportunity.
The biker gang thinks their buddy just moved to another city for work. They don't connect him to the raid.
Tier 2 is legal protections. If an undercover officer does need to testify, and this is rare, but it happens, they can do so under conditions of anonymity. Public interest immunity applications, face and voice distortion in court, testimony from behind a screen. But as we mentioned in the prompt, this requires judicial approval, and it's not automatically granted. The defense has the right to challenge the anonymity, and courts are increasingly skeptical of blanket protections. Tier 3 is long-term identity management. The UK's undercover policing unit has what they call a post-operational management protocol. After an operation ends, the officer goes through a mandatory 6-month decompression period with psychological support. Then there's a risk assessment that determines the next step. They might return to regular duties in a different unit. They might transfer to a different force entirely. Or, in the most serious cases, they enter a witness protection style program, new identity, relocation, ongoing threat monitoring.
How often does that actually happen? The full relocation?
The 2022 HMICFRS report, that's Her Majesty's Inspectorate of Constabulary and Fire and Rescue Services, found that 15% of undercover officers required relocation after major operations. That's about 1 in 7. And I want to be clear about what relocation means here. It's not just moving to a different city, it's a new name, new identity documents, new employment history. The cost for a single officer relocation, according to a 2019 UK case, was £180,000.
£180,000 to make one officer disappear into a new life. That's the price of a small house in some parts of the country. And that's just the financial cost.
Here's the thing that doesn't get discussed enough. The unique risk of what they call blown cover without public exposure. This is when an officer's identity becomes known to the criminal group but not to the public. Maybe someone in the gang figured it out, or there was a leak, or the officer's real name appeared in a document that got shared within the network. In these cases, the officer's cover is blown where it matters most, among people who might want to hurt them. But there's no public acknowledgement that would force the department to take action.
The officer knows they're compromised. The criminals know they're compromised. But officially, nothing has happened. What do you do with that officer?
They're typically restricted to administrative roles. Internal affairs, training, records. They can't go back into any kind of operational work because they're a liability. There was a 2018 case involving a Met officer who was outed to a drug cartel through a leaked police database. The officer was never publicly identified, but the cartel knew who he was and where he lived. He spent the next 5 years doing paperwork in a secure facility, effectively benched for the rest of his career.
That's a strange kind of limbo. You're not in witness protection, you're not in danger in a way that triggers the full relocation protocol, but you're also not safe. You're just...
That waiting has a psychological cost that the research is only now starting to quantify properly. The University of Cambridge's Institute of Criminology published a study in 2024 that looked at long-term outcomes for undercover officers. The numbers are stark. PTSD rates at 23%, more than double the rate for regular officers. Alcohol misuse at 31%. And relationship breakdown, this one really got me, 47%. Nearly half of undercover officers' marriages or long-term relationships end during or shortly after an operation.
That 47% number, it makes a certain grim sense. You've spent 2 years being someone else. You've built relationships in your cover identity that feel real, even though you know they're not. And then you come home to a spouse who's been living with a ghost. Someone who calls occasionally from a burner phone, who can never talk about their day, who might not even use their real name when they're at home because they're afraid of slipping up.
The decompression period is supposed to address this, but most officers report that 6 months isn't nearly enough. There's a phenomenon they call cover bleed, where elements of the cover identity persist after the operation ends. Mannerisms, speech patterns, even preferences for food or music that belong to the cover, not the officer. One officer in the Cambridge study reported that he'd spent 3 years as a member of a far-right group, and after the operation ended, he found himself instinctively using the group's slang and thought patterns in conversations with his family. It took him 2 years of therapy to feel like himself again.
That's the thing Hollywood never shows. The spy comes home, hangs up the disguise, and goes back to normal life. But the research suggests that normal life isn't something you can just step back into. The cover identity doesn't just disappear. It leaves a residue.
That's assuming the operation ends cleanly. Let me give you a case that illustrates how messy this can get in practice. The FBI's Operation Crew Cut 2015-2020. Undercover agents infiltrated the Trinitarios gang, one of the most violent street gangs in New York. But the undercover officers' covers were never publicly exposed. After the trial, the FBI relocated several of those officers to different states and gave them new identities. Not because their covers were blown, but because the risk of eventual exposure was high enough that the Bureau decided it wasn't worth waiting for a reprisal to happen.
The protection isn't just reactive, it's preemptive. They're relocating officers based on a risk model, not an actual threat. Which makes sense, but also means you're upending someone's life based on a probability.
That probability is calculated by people whose job is to assume the worst. The threat assessment teams look at the reach of the criminal organization, their history of violence against informants, their access to law enforcement databases, and they make a call. If the risk crosses a threshold, the officer disappears. Sometimes the officer doesn't get much say in it.
Let me ask about a scenario that's been nagging at me. What about the flip side? When the cover is blown publicly, not leaked to the criminals, but actually reported in the media, with the officer's real name and face out there, what does the protection framework do with that?
That's essentially a catastrophic failure of the system, and it triggers the maximum response. The officer and their immediate family are moved within hours. New identities, new location, new everything. The UK has a protocol for this. It's classified, but from what's been revealed through the undercover policing inquiry, it involves a dedicated relocation team that can have an officer and their family in a new home with new documents within 48 hours. The cost for that kind of emergency relocation can run to over £200,000, and that's just the first year.
The officer's career is effectively over at that point. You can't be a police officer under a false identity in a new city. That's a whole new level of complication.
Most officers in that situation are medically retired or transferred to a completely different role under their new identity, sometimes working for a different agency entirely. There are former undercover officers living in the UK right now under names that aren't their birth names, working jobs that have nothing to do with policing, who will never be able to tell their children what they used to do.
We've talked about the mechanics and the aftermath. Now let's step back and ask, what does this mean for the officers themselves and for the rest of us? Because there's a tension here that goes beyond operational details. We're asking people to do something that we know will likely damage them psychologically, cost the taxpayer hundreds of thousands of pounds, and produce intelligence that often can't be used in court. What's the justification for maintaining this capability?
The justification, from a law enforcement perspective, is that some criminal networks are simply impenetrable from the outside. You can surveil a drug cartel for years and never understand its command structure, its supply chains, its vulnerabilities. An undercover officer gives you the inside view, not just evidence for prosecution, but a map of how the organization actually works. The FBI's operation against the Lucchese crime family from 2017 to 2022 is a good example. A single undercover agent spent 4 years as a made man, a full member of the mafia. He recorded over 1,000 hours of conversations. That intelligence didn't just lead to convictions, it gave the FBI a complete picture of how a modern American mafia family operates, from recruitment to money laundering to inter-family politics.
1,000 hours of conversations. That's 41 full days of talking, and every single one of those conversations was a performance, where one wrong word could get you killed.
That's the pressure. And the agent in that case, his identity is still classified, by the way, reportedly lost 40 pounds during the operation, developed a stress-related heart condition, and went through a divorce shortly after it ended. The Bureau considers the operation a major success.
The Bureau considers the operation a major success. That sentence is doing a lot of work.
and I think it gets at something important about how we evaluate these operations. The metrics are convictions, disrupted networks, seized assets. The human cost to the officer is noted, but not weighted the same way. The 2024 Cambridge study I mentioned, one of its key findings was that the psychological support framework for undercover officers is systematically under-resourced. The six-month decompression period is a minimum, but it's treated as a maximum by budget-conscious departments. Officers are pushed back into regular duty before they're ready.
If the research shows that nearly half of them lose their marriages and nearly a quarter develop PTSD, the decompression period isn't just insufficient, it's almost performative. It's there so the department can say they provided support, not because 6 months is what the evidence says is needed.
The evidence says 2 to 3 years of sustained psychological support is closer to what's needed, and even then, some officers never fully reintegrate. There's a concept in the literature called identity residue. The cover identity doesn't just fade away, it becomes part of the officer's personality in ways that are hard to untangle. If you've spent 3 years as a charismatic, risk-taking drug dealer named Mike, and you come back to being a quiet, methodical police officer named James, there's a good chance that some part of Mike is going to stick around. And Mike might not be a great fit for a stable marriage or a desk job.
That's the dark side of being good at this job. The very traits that make you an effective undercover officer. Adaptability, comfort with deception, ability to compartmentalize, are the traits that make reintegration hardest. You've trained yourself to be someone else so thoroughly that you've partially overridden who you were.
This connects to something I think about a lot with these numbers. The UK has 200 to 300 undercover officers at any time. That's not a lot of people. But each of those people represents a multi-year investment of training, a legend that took months to build, and an operation that might run for years. The sunk cost per officer is enormous, which means there's a perverse incentive to keep using the same officers for multiple deployments, even when the psychological evidence says that multiple deep cover assignments compound the damage.
You've got a small, highly trained, psychologically vulnerable workforce that's too expensive to replace easily and too valuable to bench. That's a recipe for burning people out.
It's not just the officers. There's an ethical dimension to the legend construction that we touched on earlier. When a legend is built using a deceased person's identity, with family consent, yes, that family is now part of the operation's security perimeter. If the cover is blown, the family of the deceased person whose identity was borrowed could face harassment or worse. The UK's undercover policing inquiry has uncovered cases where families were never told how their loved one's identity was being used or were given only partial information.
Wait, families weren't told? I thought you said it was done with family consent.
In some cases, the consent was, let's say, broadly interpreted. A family might have been asked if their deceased son's identity could be used for police purposes without being told it would be used to infiltrate a violent criminal organization for years. The inquiry has been quite critical of how this was handled historically, and the protocols have been tightened significantly since the inquiry began.
The ethical footprint of an undercover operation extends well beyond the officer. It includes the families of the deceased whose identities are borrowed, the communities where the legends are planted, the criminal associates who may have befriended the officer. There's a whole web of collateral consequence.
For the rest of us, for citizens who might wonder why any of this matters to their daily lives, there's the accountability question. The 2023 UK Undercover Policing Inquiry has revealed systemic failures in record-keeping and oversight, operations that weren't properly authorized, cover identities that were used long after the operation ended, intelligence files that were lost or destroyed. When you combine a highly secretive operational model with inadequate oversight, you get exactly the kind of abuses the inquiry has documented.
That's the structural problem. Undercover policing is inherently secret. You can't do it transparently. But that very secrecy makes oversight difficult, and the lack of oversight creates space for misconduct. It's not that undercover officers are disproportionately corrupt. It's that the system is designed in a way that makes corruption hard to detect.
The intelligence-to-evidence gap we mentioned earlier compounds this. If most undercover work produces intelligence rather than evidence, then most undercover work never faces the scrutiny of a courtroom. The defense never gets to challenge the officer's methods. The judge never gets to rule on whether the operation crossed a line. The whole thing stays in the shadows.
For someone listening who wants to understand whether an undercover operation they read about in the news was legitimate or not, what should they look for?
A few things. First, was there judicial authorization? In the UK, undercover operations that involve long-term infiltration require authorization under the Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act, and that authorization has to be renewed regularly. Second, was there an exit strategy? Competent undercover operations have a defined endpoint and a plan for extracting the officer safely. Third, and this is harder to assess from the outside, was the operation proportionate? Did the intrusion into people's lives match the seriousness of the crime being investigated? The undercover policing inquiry has a lot of material on what happens when these safeguards fail. Listeners can follow the findings at their website, usip.gov.uk.
That's practical, and I think it's worth saying explicitly, the spy movie version of undercover work is misleading in almost every particular. The real thing is slower, more bureaucratic, more psychologically damaging, and more ethically complicated than anything you see on screen. The drama isn't in the car chases and the shootouts. It's in the slow erosion of a person's identity over years of sustained deception.
The aftermath is where the real story usually is. Not the infiltration, but what happens when the operation ends and the officer has to figure out who they are without the cover. That's the part that doesn't make it into the news coverage, because it's not dramatic in a visual way. It's just people in therapy offices and divorce courts in quiet suburban houses where someone is trying to remember how to have a normal conversation.
If I'm tracking the arc of this correctly, we've got a tiny number of officers, selected through intense psychological screening, trained for up to a year, deployed for years at a time, producing intelligence that often can't be used in court, protected by a multi-tier framework that costs hundreds of thousands of pounds per officer, and coming home to high rates of PT, SD, addiction, and divorce. And this is considered a successful model.
I'd say it's considered a necessary model. Whether it's successful depends on what you're measuring. If you're measuring convictions and disrupted networks, the model works. Operation Galton, Operation Crew Cut, the Lucchese operation all produced results. If you're measuring the human cost, the model is expensive in ways that don't show up on a budget sheet. The question isn't really whether undercover policing should exist, it's whether we're being honest about what it costs and who pays that cost.
That brings us to the forward-looking question. As AI-generated identities and deepfake social media profiles become easier to create, what happens to this world? The 2025 UK government pilot of AI-generated legend management suggests that the technology is already being integrated into cover construction. You can generate a fake social media history in hours instead of months. You can create synthetic backstopping, AI voices that answer verification calls, deepfake photos that populate the legend's timeline.
Which makes undercover operations cheaper and faster to deploy, but also introduces new risks. If an AI-generated legend has a flaw that a human-built legend wouldn't, a temporal inconsistency, a cultural detail that's slightly wrong, and that flaw gets the officer killed, who's responsible? The cover manager who signed off on it? The AI vendor? The department that decided to cut corners on legend construction?
There's also the escalation risk. If police forces can generate convincing legends with AI, criminal organizations can use the same technology to create convincing fake identities to infiltrate police forces. The asymmetry might actually benefit the criminals. They have fewer bureaucratic constraints on how they use the technology.
That's the arms race nobody's talking about. But I think the deeper question, and this is probably a topic for another episode, is where the line is between legitimate deception and entrapment. When you can generate a perfect fake identity in a day and deploy an officer who has been psychologically conditioned to build intimate relationships with targets, the potential for overreach is significant. At what point does the undercover officer stop being an observer and start being a participant in creating the crime they're investigating?
That's the ethical boundary that the legal framework is still struggling to define, and it's going to get harder as the technology improves. But that's for another day. For now, I think the takeaway is that undercover policing is a high-cost, high-risk strategy that exists in permanent tension with the legal system's demand for admissible evidence. The protection framework is robust, but imperfect. The psychological toll is often lifelong, and the public oversight is structurally limited by the secrecy the work requires. If you're reading a news story about an undercover operation, the real story is usually in the aftermath, not the infiltration.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1525, a Persian pigment maker in Tabriz, working from imported Caspian Basin indigo, accidentally synthesized the first stable copper phthalocyanine blue, a pigment so durable it would not be commercially rediscovered for another 4 centuries, and which now colors everything from car paint to the robes of Buddhist monks.
A 400-year head start on car paint. That's impressive.
That's going to sit with me.
If you found this interesting, we've had an episode on the intelligence to evidence gap that goes deeper into why so much undercover work never sees a courtroom. It's available now wherever you get your podcasts. This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. We'll catch you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.